And that's the thing. As long as it turns a profit, then the commodity has done its job. And the problem is that, well, every commodity contains an ideology of some kind, but the commodity of a film is far more of an ideological one. And if it's there to confirm or deny prejudices that are already there, then that's a real fucking problem. And I think one of the things the left has forgotten right now is its ability to actually call that for what it is. I think the dismissiveness, say, like, of the Frankfurt School or the Situationists on the part of most of the American left, anyway, for the past 30 or 40 years, has really hobbled us in being able to examine and understand better what the culture industry does and how it operates in relation to ideology and in relation to the balance of class forces.
Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. We are doing the first of what we're going to call features, where we will be sort of going off the beaten path, and I will be just myself or maybe one other person interviewing people that we think that you should know about, who are involved in projects that we think you should know about. And today with us, we have Alex Billett from Red Wedge Magazine? Red Wedge Magazine,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Red Wedge Magazine, yes, yeah.
And Alex is the managing editor of Red Wedge and is one of the founders of Red Wedge, if not the founder of Red Wedge.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
I think I'm the only, I'm definitely the only of the original editors left on the editorial board at this point.
Tell us a little bit about Red Wedge. Yeah, just give us a little rundown of what Red Wedge is.
Yeah, gladly. So Red Wedge is a website and publication that is dedicated to examining all of the arts through a Marxist lens. We like to think of ourselves as playing a role in rekindling the revolutionary imagination, which is one of the slogans we have on our masthead. But we also try to boost the work of artists, poets, fiction writers who are themselves radicals, who are themselves part of the anti-capitalist left. We try to lift up their work, we try to amplify it, and we try to put it out there. And we also are trying to reconstruct, actually, in many ways, one of the many things that the revolutionary left has lost in the sort of wasteland of neoliberalism, which is our ability to relate to, analyze, and participate in cultural creation and to reestablish a revolutionary way of looking at the arts and participating in the arts and seeing it again as a battlefield, as a realm of struggle. So we very much see it as a way of boosting and rebuilding the militant revolutionary artistic left, which has existed before in the United States and has always actually been a key part of any left that has been able to actually vie for power, to actually vie for hegemony among people's ideas. You look at the Communist Party in the 1930s, you look at SDS and well, really the whole left in the 1960s and 70s, you look at the art that came out of the Black Panther movement, the Black Arts movement, the great feminist art that was being made mm-hmm. as the Women's Liberation Movement gained steam. Art has always been part of a revolutionary vision.
You mentioned that you're mm-hmm. yeah. the last original member of the founding group that became Red Wedge. You know, how did this all get started? You know, where did it come from? Where was the idea born?
I think it really came together, if I'm remembering my years correctly. It was myself and several comrades that were attending the Socialism Conference in Chicago that's done every year by the ISO and Haymarket Books and the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. And that year, China Mieville spoke at the conference. He spoke in particular sort of, well, what you would expect for someone like China Mieville, revolutionary Marxist, novelist. About really the basics on how Marxists should be approaching art. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us were actually very dissatisfied with the discussion after that. China gave a great presentation, there's no doubt about it. And he actually, I think his work continues to be a very big influence on the outlook of most of the Red Wedge editors.
And us as well. on the
exactly.
podcast.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. I think the work that he's been doing with Salvage in particular, on top of his novels and just writing in general, it's very, very key. And I think we are extremely lucky to have someone like him being part of the far left right now. But we were really dissatisfied with the discussion afterwards. And it seemed like people were still operating at very kind of a base level that could be kind of crude, that still limited their sense of analysis of all of these, of art, to what I like, what I don't like, or still looking at art as politics before you look at it as art.
Yeah.
So we all know bad political art, and we all unfortunately know plenty of leftists who are willing to defend that art as art simply because it's the politics of its creator are good.
I remember coming into politics being pretty young, in my late teens and early 20s, and
sure.
just grasping onto pretty much any radical leftist, anti-capitalist artwork. And that was my thing now. And it exposed me to so much terrible music and terrible art that in retrospect, I'm like, oh God, I can't listen to this.
Yeah.
This is bad.
I'm a little embarrassed by some of the tastes that I had when I first became a revolutionary, but that's also, we don't want to be too embarrassed by it. It's part of a political process, and I think it's bound to happen, particularly given what we were talking about earlier, which is the fact that the left still is small, is only just beginning to approach questions about what it means to influence the sort of whole conversation. And when you're small like that, when you're small and ineffectual, you're going to be gravitating towards anything that, especially when you're just becoming interested in it.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly a bad thing. That's part of a process. The thing is that it needs to continue to be part of a process. Mm-hmm. And so that means as you become a better leftist, as you become a more experienced Marxist, that means also that your analysis and your approach to art also has to deepen, also has to become more sophisticated, also has to actually grow, really, along with your tastes, along with your knowledge for how the world works. And we thought that, okay, this is good. China Mieville came to speak to an audience of American socialists. So it's a good start. How do we build on that? And how do we actually take on some of the arguments, some of the crudeness that the American left was still holding on to? So at the conference, myself and a handful of other comrades got together. And these are people who had been active in one way or another, not just as socialists, but as artists. Some of us were actors or poets or performance artists or played in punk rock bands. We had obviously an interest in the arts. Not saying we were experts, but we were starting to pick out some ways in which we felt it was that the left needed to grow and deepen its aesthetic analysis. And so we decided, well, let's start up a blog. Let's start reaching out to some of the creatives that we know out there. And let's start publishing some of these ideas to try to raise the level, to try to boost the level a little bit. And what we found out during those initial conversations is a lot of people had been thinking for some time that there needed to be something like Red Wave. In 2012, we released our first pamphlet, I believe 2 years later, 2014, that was called The Thunder of New and Dangerous Myths.
Yeah.
That came out 2014. We released our first full issue 2015. And we just released our sixth issue last month, actually, in November.
And I just subscribed for the first time ever.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much doing that.
And I'm waiting on that.
It's in the mail. It definitely is in the mail by this point. Just so you know, yeah. Honestly, it's been kind of a tedious journey at times. It's been just trying to figure out, okay, what is working? What isn't working? I mean, this is particularly because, at least among the original editorial board, none of us had experience in publishing. Other than maybe writing articles or things like that, none of us had been on the editorial board of a magazine before. So it's really been a lot of trial and error over the past 6 years. And I think we've just finally found sort of not only a publication schedule and an online format that works for us, but really kind of an analytical framework that we think works for us, a framework that it actually can that actually can get some traction and pull an audience around it and can really intervene in some of the debates that are starting to take place around art and socialist politics.
Okay, so that actually segues really well into what I'd like to talk about next. Mm-hmm. I think when most people think about political art, what comes to mind is pretty typically something like a bunch of people with their fist in the air, men swinging hammers, or mm-hmm. a cartoon pig wearing a top hat scowling at workers, or mm-hmm. Red Wedge. Mm-hmm. Red Wedge seems to be interested in sort of pushing the boundaries a little bit more than that, getting much more creative and talking about and pushing forward weird and uncomfortable things.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the state of revolutionary aesthetics and tell me how Red Wedge feels we can break new ground.
So I think being able to actually look back on the past aesthetics that the left has used, be it art from the Russian Revolution or socialist realism from the age of Stalinism or some of the stuff I was talking about earlier coming from the Black Panthers.
Yeah.
This is all good. I'm glad that we look back on this mm-hmm. with a favorable worldview.
Honestly, like it doesn't get much better than the France in 1968 stencils.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So great. Yeah. Those are, I mean, I have several of those on my wall or copies yeah. of them. They were meant to provoke. They were meant to reveal something to people, not just about the machinations of the system, but the way in which they were complicit and could choose to not be complicit in the system.
Right.
So this is all incredibly useful, but I think there's a way in which that can be celebrated that is fairly one-dimensional and nostalgic. And I think that if we're going to actually learn from those aesthetics, then we need to actually have an eye towards creating, recreating, re-inspiring, and finding something new. And because the reason that those artworks were effective is because they spoke not just to a topic that people was on people's minds, but again, there was something in the way that in the actual aesthetic, not just what they were talking about, but how they talked about it, mm-hmm. that was relevant to the structure of feeling, as Raymond Williams would call it, that people were enduring every single day and experiencing every single day. And the reason that art, the reason I say it's a nostalgic way to look at it is because what we forget is that aesthetic doesn't read as well today. It's not a value right. judge. It's not a value judgment. It's not a moral thing. It's not to say it's bad art or ineffective art. In fact, it is very good and effective art because it spoke to its time.
And that's one of the things we talk about a lot is revolutionary LARPing. You know,
yeah, where, exactly.
Marxists will, you know, their profile picture will be of, you know, Lenin, and they'll wear mm-hmm. like a USSR t-shirt to a protest or, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Stuff like that. It's sort of just, it's play acting at being a revolutionary. And I kind of see the overusage of, say, Bolshevik art or mm-hmm. Cultural revolution art and expecting that to appeal to a mass audience and motivate them to do something. It's a little bit silly.
I think so. It's in the 18th Brumaire, Marx talks about how past revolutions or the bourgeois revolution, whatever it is, or the current order will always take its poetry from the past. Mm-hmm. But a revolutionary needs to pull its poetry from the future. And that's harder to do. It's also far more effective when it comes to actually creating art that can speak towards people, that can give them, that can speak to where people are at, what their present circumstances are, but also imbue them with a vision of the future. But when we talk about constructing a poetry of the future right now, I think that's something mm-hmm. that we need to actually be very, very, we need to take that seriously. That's not just a phrase. So I think that means being able to think of artistic and aesthetic conventions as something that is fluid and very much socially constructed, that is, again, it's a lot more difficult to do, but it also mm-hmm. means when you're able to get a hang on it, then you can start to see, okay, this is this aesthetic, this marker, this signifier, this look of a painting or a poster, this style, this piece of clothing, this piece of music. This is why it speaks to people. How is capitalism shaping this? How is the culture industry shaping this? And how would we, as people who are workers who want to actually, and not just workers, but just people who want to actually reshape daily life, how do we relate to that? Not just how do we relate to that, but how do we explode that? How do we find the cracks in the edifice? How do we look at, say, a billboard, an artistic expression like of a billboard that's promoting a movie, and how do we turn that inside out? How do we make people face that violence, the daily violence that not just everyone else is experiencing, but they are experiencing? I guess the question for me is, like, what role does art play in subject formation, in your subjectivity, in being able to perceive yourself, the world around you, and your relationship to the world? And how does that expose you to different ways in which that configuration can exist? Again, a much more difficult prospect than just sort of looking at a constructivist poster from 1919 and holding it up placard-like and saying, we need more of this. Because, yeah,
more
we need
of the red wedge.
Yeah, more. Yeah, we need more of the red. I mean, you know, obviously we called ourselves Red Wedge in relationship to that Lissitzky painting, but it wasn't meant to be.
No, it's
nostalgic.
Great.
Yeah,
I love that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks. Because we see ourselves as an intervention, and we see that we see culture and aesthetic creation as playing a role in intervening into the world.
So, reading Red Wedge's sort of, I guess, mission statement, you come across the concept of rebuilding or building the popular avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of seems to be what the entire project is oriented around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think this pulls from what I was saying earlier and what we were just talking about. If we are going to actually look at art, music, film, and how it exists today, it necessarily begs the question of, how can art be remade? How can it be turned into something? How can it be pushed forward? How can it evolve? Because it needs to. If it's going to stay relevant, then it needs to. And one of the unfortunate things about the avant-garde today as it exists is that in some ways it actually doesn't exist. The artists that are talked about the most as avant-garde or groundbreaking or whatever really have a lot of their content and form very much blunted by a disconnection from the struggles and concerns of ordinary people day in and day out and our daily experiences. And the thing is, that's actually fairly exceptional in the history of capitalism. Past avant-garde movements, whether we're talking about the Situationists or the Surrealists or any kind of new music, jazz, as it came when it was first coming up in the 19 teens and 20s, and especially going through the 30s and 60s, all of these avant-garde movements in the past have been connected in one way or another with the daily life of ordinary people. And actually, it's that experience, those struggles, that very much informed the way in which they aesthetically broke from what had come before, the way in which they shattered convention, the way in which they created something new. So in some ways, the popular avant-garde, it's not a concept that we came up with. It's always existed. But why we put the popular on there is sort of as a readjustment, as a way to actually reassert that the avant-garde, if it's going to be avant-garde, if it's going to actually push forward our aesthetic understanding, our understanding of the world generally, and open us up to new ideas and new visions and new configurations of the world, then it can't just be come up with, it can't just come out of some artist working in, who has the patronage of, say, you know, this museum or this or that benefactor, just working in a room by themselves and just doing something new. I mean, what do you get when you get that? You get Damien Hirst, who I think is a fucking charlatan, and I think is just incredibly, incredibly uninteresting, and I think is actually best encapsulated with the jeweled skull. He's, you know, you can say, oh, this is a commentary on It's a commentary on the way in which money deadens you. It's like, no, that's not what it was. It was.
I just fell asleep while you were saying that.
You're right. Yeah. It's none of these. A jeweled skull is so freaking blasé and so obvious that it doesn't tell anyone anything they don't already know.
Right.
They people know that they're being fucked. People know that the rich are controlling. Yeah, and if you're going to call it a commentary on the art world, fine. But comment is never enough. Comment is never enough. The key is being able to actually look at where you're at right now and being able to see the opening of new horizons from it. That's what good art always does, be it a Van Gogh painting or your favorite punk rock song, or, well, good punk rock, you know, if we're talking about The Clash or Gang of Four or things like that. That's what that does. It opens up your horizon. The avant-garde today, insofar as it actually exists, is not interested in opening new horizons. It's interested in experimenting and tinkering in a very small sandbox. And so being able to actually reassert a popular avant-garde is something that I think is about reinvigorating art itself and aesthetic creation itself, apart from the machinations of the culture industry that are currently deadening it. But it also means showing to people the possibility of recreation of daily life. The recreation of themselves, of daily life, and of the world generally. So if you look at art anthropologically, it's always been, what's the best way to put it?
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's always been pretty cool. Yeah, art has always been very cool. But it's also, artistic creation has not been, for most of human history, was not thought of as something separate from daily life.
Right.
This is something, if you read someone like Ernst Fischer, on the necessity of art, excellent Marxist arts critic, art was not considered something separate from daily life because daily life required creativity. It required a constant remaking of your situation, of life. That's what cave paintings represented. They were imagination, but they were also stories, and they were useful. You know, how to bring down this mammoth. You know, that's something that you need so you don't starve. But it also allows people to see themselves as bigger than they actually are and imagine how you can move forward through life. And so it's only with the rise of class society that art starts to get, with the division of labor, you know, the segmenting out of so many different things, you know, who makes this, who makes that, where is this made, who controls the means of production. It's only with that distribution and fracturing and atomization of labor that we start to see art as separate. And that also hobbles our imagination because we no longer see daily life as something that can be remade at all.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a tragedy because daily life does have to be remade, not just to put an end to the way in which our souls are deadened and our bodies are broken at work, but actually to give people more of a democratic purchase and remake. If we can reimagine what a city looks like or how it operates, you know, if we're going to talk about staving off climate change and remaking a city in a more green and sustainable way, then first of all, you definitely need a revolution at this point.
Yeah.
We have about 12 years to come up with one of those. But Lord knows if we will.
I'm going to say I'm not optimistic.
No, me either. But it's sort of like what you were saying in the pessimism episode, that a dying planet is still worth fighting for.
Right.
And a civilization of some kind. And that is definitely going to require a kind of democratic, collective participation and creativity. Remaking, say, just a city to not be so reliant on cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, like rethinking everything. Housing, what work is like, what happens when you go to work. This is going to take massive democratic participation and collectivity. And that's really what the popular avant-garde is. It's meant to point the way toward an unleashing of collective creativity on the part of working and oppressed people.
It seems as though the sort of dark and bleak aesthetic that illustrates what our prospects are like is absolutely necessary in art right now. If we're trying to get across the idea that we've got no choice because otherwise humanity might not survive whatever's in store for us. I think that's a very sort of an unpopular opinion to take, you know, because no one likes to be told that time is running out and there's not a lot of hope. But I think it's absolutely necessary. And it seems as though, and I'm not an art critic, it seems as though art needs that more now than ever.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that Red Wedge's Marxism is definitely a very gothic Marxism, which is very much the Marxism of people like Walter Benjamin, of the Situationists, of the Surrealists, most of whom, at least in their original generation, were communists. But it was a pessimistic, it was a revolutionary pessimism, to be perfectly frank. Not having a heck of a lot of faith in what the system is going to be able to provide. And therefore, that puts a very big pressure and onus on us to reimagine. But that also means not shying away from the wreckage that we're actually faced with right now.
Right.
I mean, the optimism that we are being told to adopt, and that too much of the left, unfortunately, apes, it's suicidal. It's suicidal in so many ways. That in our most recent issue, in issue 6, one of the artists that we feature is a fellow named Anupam Roy, who he lives in India. He's a fantastic artist, and he's an active communist. And we feature two types of art from him in the most recent issue. He's on the cover, and he's also, we feature some of his more agitprop type of work that's more geared towards defending, say, the Pricall 8, who are, I believe, workers that were locked up for organizing in the workplace. You know, so like Free the Pricall 8 is in there, but then also some of the work that he does as an artist outside of the CP, some of which actually speaks far more to the horror of daily life, of just the planet. It's very eldritch, very surreal. In some ways, it reminds me of just as a way to sort of maybe conjure up some images in your listeners' minds, short of actually going to the website and getting a copy of the issue.
They should do that too, though.
Yeah, they should definitely do that too. But if people want an idea of what it looks like, do you remember those Scary Stories books from back in the 90s? Yeah, the original
Scary
ones.
Stories to Tell in the Dark?
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The Alvin Schwartz illustrations.
Yeah, those are terrifying.
Which you look at them now, and I love them, but I also think, holy fuck, why was I allowed to read this?
Yeah, this is not for children.
This is not for children. I'm 8 years old, and I'm looking at this, like, skull growing out of the ground or something like that. And and of course I loved it, because kids love being scared. Adults love being scared, too.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to something. And that actually, I'm reminded a lot of that when I look at some of Anupam's work. And I think being able to face the eldritch, being able to look at the wreckage, and also have it light your imagination up so that you can see sort of the excess. You can see the cracks that form within the wreckage and maybe be able to reach into the rubble and pull something out. That is what art needs right now. And I think the best art is doing that. I think one of my reference points of some actually really effective art that has been created in our time is vaporwave music. Now, it more hit its stride, I guess, maybe about 6 or so years ago. And right now, I think it's sort of gone past its prime. It's hit its apex and it's on the decline. Not to say that many of those artists aren't still actually making very, very interesting music. But it's this idea of recapitulating sort of the Windows 95 aesthetic. If Windows 95 suddenly became self-aware and, you know, and suddenly realized, wait, I'm obsolete now. But I still go on.
That speaks to me.
Yeah, that speaks to all of us, because all of us are having to say, like, you know, if you're unemployed looking around for a job, what do you feel if not obsolete? And what does that do?
Oh, I have a degree in history.
Right, exactly. You know? and we're walking around like feeling like used commodities. And so that was the reason that
or
they
unused
it.
Commodities
or
in my
unused.
Case.
Yeah, exactly. Ones that are just sort of like, you know, the surplus
sitting in a warehouse rotting.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's very, and that's what Vaporwave actually really spoke to, I think. And still does to a certain degree, which is now that there's a qualifier in there, which is that there is sort of a movement within that of fascists, of fash wave right now.
Fash wave, yes, I'm familiar.
But the thing that I noticed with them is actually the irony is gone from it. Like they actually,
oh, it's very derivative.
Yeah, it's very derivative, and if you listen to it, it's very clear that they actually see the sort of digital regimentation of life as a good thing.
Yes,
and which negates exactly what Vaporwave was about to be. It was supposed to be a rebellion, a sort of way to use the contradiction of that digital regimentation against itself. So that's one of the reasons why Fashwave is derivative. And which, you know, I should put a qualifier in there. There is unfortunately plenty of good art made by fascists. There's some brilliant fascist novelists that existed, especially like back during the heyday of, you know, the 20s, 30s, and 40s of fascism.
The futurist movement.
Exactly.
It's at the very foundation of fascism, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. If we talk
not
about
to say
Marinetti,
that all futurists were fascists, but, you know.
It's very interesting to me. And actually, I think this goes towards one of the things that was raised on the episode that you all did on fascism, on what, how do you define fascism? Which is if you compare Russian futurism with Italian futurism, both of them are embracing the revolutionary movement of their respective countries because that's new. Because that is the new, that's what's going to smash the past and allow us to actually have this gleaming, glittering future. But of course, what's the social content of those revolutionary movements? Obviously, you know, you went over it last time, that both fascism and revolutionary communism are revolutionary movements. But they are, what they actually point to and what they actually achieve is, you know, the social substance of it is very different.
Absolutely.
One liberates, the other atomizes. And that's something that if you look at the Italian futurist sort of, just sort of rote celebration of war as a liberating force of some kind. Marinetti is all over about this. You compare that to, say, the futurists like Mayakovsky, where it was still very much this idea of leave the past behind, let's smash the past and build something, but there was more of a sense of collectivity in it. And that's one of the reasons why he shot himself after Stalin took over, frankly. Because that potential of rebuilding the future in a collective way was just the dream was over. It was gone.
Just as a disclaimer here, neither Red Wedge nor The Regrettable Century recommend that you consume fascist art, even if it is good.
Or if consume it with a far more critical lens. Like I'm not going to tell anyone to not listen to Death in June. But be aware of what you're hearing and be aware of actually how coercive this shit can be, because art plays in our senses in a way that's libidinal, in a way that does feel subconscious. That's precisely why we need to be a very critical of good fascist art. And even be critical of good revolutionary art and being conscious of this is part of what it means to have an aesthetic, a Marxist aesthetic understanding, is being conscious of the ways in which art works on our subconscious. I think a Marxism that shuns psychoanalysis is a useless Marxism, frankly. Because it denies you a very crucial avenue of subject formation, and specifically with art, it denies you a way of just understanding what art does to you. Why our songs, our paintings, our films, our plays, our poems, why they inhabit such a role they do in our psyche.
That actually, Death in June brings me to a point that I wanted to make, and I would say probably about 90% of Death in June's fascist aesthetics are just transgression, but, you know, that's not a defense of using fascist aesthetics.
No.
But I just wanted to bring the conversation around to transgression.
Yes.
Because that seems to be key in your newest issue,
which
I have not yet read, but I'm very much looking forward to. But
again, it'll be in your mailbox soon, I promise.
What do you see as the role of artistic transgression in shaping a potential socialist future? Because transgression, this is something that has been very important in the alt-right, I think,
yes.
in appealing to young, disaffected men, is the transgressive nature of fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that transgression is appealing to anyone who is looking for a break from just the mundane, modern society, day-to-day
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
How can socialists utilize artistic transgression to shape our potential future?
Well, I think the question really, first of all, is just understanding that there is a tendency, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted the issue to be based around defense of transgression, because I think mm-hmm. right now, in this new socialist left that's sort of cobbling it together right now, there is a tendency of what Kate Doyle Griffiths, who's interviewed in the issue, calls normie socialism. You know, this
right.
idea that appealing to working people is very much, we can't weird them out too much.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes when people talk like that, have you ever fucking spoken to a working class person? Like, we are weird. We are weird.
Yeah.
There is not a single one of us who doesn't go to underground music shows or like to experience weird art. And if we don't have access to some of that, then we have a fetish of some kind that we repress, that we repress. And we certainly don't tell our coworkers or even our wives or husbands about it. We are the human experience is a weird experience. It is an experience of deeply internalized trauma. And that makes us very weird. That makes us very, very, that gives us these urges, these libidinal impulses that we all want to let out. And so to say that that's what transgression is, and that's, again, why transgression is so important to forming an individual subject, an identity of some kind that makes you feel more human. And that, in turn, that individual subject formation is crucial to a collective, to a forming of a proletarian subject, of a revolutionary proletarian subject. It's absolutely crucial. Now, that's not to say that transgression is a substitute for actual working class collective power or the building,
right.
the simple building of a movement that needs to be done. But to say that building that movement has to ignore that, the crucial role that transgression plays in being able to actually forge an identity of some kind, you cut yourself off at the knee. And frankly, where do you get at the end of that? I think you turn into Angela Nagel defending closed borders. That's what that leads to, frankly. I'm being very, very
yeah.
glib when I say that, but I think it comes from something. It comes from a sense of what the working class is, who the working class is, who they are. And also, I would say a misunderstanding of what collective power is. Without transgression, there's no way that we are actually going to actually unleash that collective power. I think it gets to what I was saying earlier about the popular avant-garde. Do you not think that people are going to be able to use that creativity, their own impulses, the unleashing of this repression? Do you or do you not believe that people have the power to do that, and that holds the power to actually reshape society? If you don't, then fine. But let's call that what it is. It's not Marxism. That belief system is not Marxism. It's at best Stalinism or left social democracy. But that places the agency of society in the state, not in working people.
So that's where I see Angela Nagel's whole viewpoint coming from, is just a sort of social democratic narrow a viewpoint with very narrow horizons. You know,
mm-hmm,
it's like
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The best we can hope for is some sort of state social democracy,
mm-hmm.
which will necessitate having borders and, you know, whatever else. And we're going to have to win over all of these racists
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in middle America, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to do that is with normie socialism.
Exactly.
Which I, you know, don't agree with, obviously.
Yeah.
the whole popular avant-garde concept sort of calls to mind, to me, the Russian prolet cult movement.
Mm-hmm.
I remember us, both of us having come from the same political tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The prolet cult was sort of shit on by our organization. You know?
Yeah.
And I've sort of since then looked back on it with fresh eyes. And, you know, I could see the value in such a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think there is. I think a lot of the kind of dismissal of the prolet cult movement in revolutionary Russia just simply comes through reading Trotsky's polemics against it, and in particular, Lenin's polemics against it. Some of which are useful, and I actually still very much, as someone who considers himself whatever the hell this label means, a post-Trotskyist. You know, Trotsky's polemics against prolet cult, some of which are useful, and I think the prolet cult movements actually didn't do everything correct. We never learned in the organization and tradition that we come out of, we never talk about the fact that prolet cult was actually, it was a mass movement. It had 800,000 members.
I didn't know that until I went back later and read about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because prolet cult was always just like, oh, prolet cult, that's like enforced proletarian culture. That's like proto-Stalinism, you know?
And that's like patently untrue. Too.
Yeah.
It's like there was a section of it that ended up getting absorbed by Stalinism, but but it was also, it had an influence.
So was the Bolshevik Party.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So frankly, if we're going to look at it as linear, then, well, we have a lot more questions to answer for. The prolet cult movement, it was about, again, using the sort of experience of everyday life to tap into, you know, mobilizing workers' creativity. Is really what it came down to. That's what it was.
I'm for that.
It had the support of the Commissar of Culture at the time, Lunacharsky, Anatoly Lunacharsky, who is a very, very, the more I read Lunacharsky,
He's so weird. I love him.
Yeah, me too. The whole God-building aesthetic is just, an approach is like, wow, this is so, like, wonderfully nihilistic in some ways. Yeah, he's an absolute weirdo. He was an absolute weirdo.
Yeah.
But he was a Commissar of Culture. He was someone who was looking to, he certainly was a better equipped than Trotsky ever was to talk about what was needed in culture, which raises the question, why weren't we reading more Lunacharsky? If we're going to talk about art, why are we just going to Art and Revolution by Trotsky? Good book, great book. But let's read more Lunacharsky. I think the left needs to read more Lunacharsky.
I think that Trotsky had a point when he said that how can the Russian working class specifically, mm-hmm. and the Russian peasantry,
mm-hmm.
Think of creating a new form of proletarian art when they've had absolutely no exposure to bourgeois art?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got nothing to draw from.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense then, right? I guess to a certain extent that makes sense. But also, it doesn't make sense now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the people who create art now, like proletarians who create art now, have that exposure. You can Google David and look at all the bourgeois art you want.
Mm-hmm.
And scroll through hundreds and hundreds of Google images. And there's podcasts, there's TED Talks, you know? I mean, I'm not advising listening to TED Talks.
No. Don't listen to fascist art. Also, don't listen to TED Talks. That's actually...
Correct.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's just one step removed from fascism.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's it. It's the California
Uberalis.
Yeah, I think it's Jerry Brown fascism. It's the California.
I'll listen to Death in June all day before I listen to TED Talks.
Yeah, no, me too. Frankly, but yeah, it's. I mean, I think that is true. Most people do have that access to the bourgeois art, the greats. You know, you can, mm-hmm. as you said. You can Google Michelangelo. You can Google Voltaire. You can be exposed to this. There's also, however, a question of let's accept the argument, Trotsky's argument. It's difficult to create a proletarian culture when you haven't been fully exposed to the bourgeois culture. Okay, but how do you expose them? How do you expose people to that? Is it just going to be by sitting all people down in a classroom? I mean, this gets into pedagogy a lot, I think. Sitting people down in a classroom and saying, this is art. Here's Michelangelo's David. Here's why it's great. You should accept that it's great. That's how capitalist schools teach you. Or do you want to have people sitting in a far more collective atmosphere and ask them, what do you think is great about this, about Michelangelo's David? What does it make you feel? How does it make you feel? That's what prolet cult was doing, frankly. I mean, they were in a far more popular education, what we would call pop ed today, kind of format. Also, I think that there's this misconception that people need to have experienced a certain level of art or music or poetry or whatever before they can create it. I think that's bullshit. I think, you know, like, what are you doing? Kids are creating art all the time. I think it's just mostly that notion that we start to have stamped into us the minute we enter schools under capitalism that that strips us of that. When in fact, actually being creative as you are learning about creativity, as you are learning, creating art while you're learning about art, that's a far more effective way to do it because it promotes creativity. It promotes critical thinking.
That's actually, you know, I grew up playing in punk rock bands and I taught myself how to play drums. And my brother, who was a guitarist, taught himself how to play guitar. And people would talk to us. They'd be like, dude, that was really weird. What were you doing on the drums? It sounded really cool, but I've never seen anyone like do that beat before. I was like, oh, no, I kind of just made it up.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's there's something to be said for the untrained. I mean, that's what punk rock was unleashing, right? The whole idea of...
Oh, now, we sucked. Technically, we sucked. But it was interesting to listen to, I think. Personally, I might be biased, but our music was interesting to listen to.
Oh, yeah, sure. And you don't want to... I think there's a way in which you can say that, you know, modern music criticism, for example, will say that sucked in a way that actually cuts you off from learning from it and building on the weirdest moments that did work or did not work as a way to actually create an aesthetic, as opposed to just saying, you suck, stop making music. That's what a lot of modern music criticism does. That's what a lot of artistic criticism did. You know, yeah, it stands up there like a teacher at the front of the classroom who hates being questioned. This is important. You know, like this is very important to what capitalism wants to turn us into. And I think we need to reject that.
Speaking of what capitalism wants to turn us into, I want to know how you think it's possible for art to have some sort of transgressive or radical effect when neoliberal capitalism purposely seeks out and commodifies expressions of dissent.
Yeah.
How do we keep neoliberalism from Rage Against the Machining our dissent?
Oh, God. I love that term, by the way. Rage Against the Machining our dissent. Yeah, right?
Thank you. I just made it up.
Hold on to it. Write something about it. That's a great term, really. Seriously. I don't think that's an easy question to answer, and I don't think we're going to be able to answer it here, except to just say that this is precisely why we need to construct a new artistic left that can create spaces that are separate, sure, but also in opposition to the spaces created by neoliberalism for art.
Right.
It's so easy to turn transgression into a marketing gimmick, which instantly makes it non-transgressive also, I would say. It's very easy to do that precisely because there are no oppositional spaces right now. I think that the problems of the art world are not going to be resolved within the art world right now. And that's true, just as true for music, for filmmaking, things like that. There is a need to create a movement and those spaces like artist collectives that existed. Again, this goes back to when the Communist Party was its most powerful, its most influential, the left in the 60s, the same thing. If we want to take the examples out of the United States, which I think we should and need to, then we should talk about, say, like Rock Against Racism in Britain in the 1970s. This was about creating a space using the expressive forces that were already there around reggae, around punk, around sort of the neon dayglow art that took a big influence from Situationism, for example. And they were tapping into that was creating a space that saw itself in opposition. That takes time. That takes resources. It takes a sense of opposition, too. I think if we're going to resolve that contradiction within art, then we need to start looking outside the art world. But that also doesn't mean that we do what so much of the left mistakes, just leaving aesthetic questions until after we have that movement.
There's a reverse problem as well.
Yeah.
When thinking aesthetic choices are in and of themselves revolutionary.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's very true. So finding the balance of that I always hate it when people say we need to think about this dialectically, comrades, but we need to think about this dialectically, comrades. we do. So you take things too far in one direction. And frankly, you end up getting the formula wrong. You know, what Rock Against Racism was able to do was create a space that was apart from the culture industry. That's going to be a far more difficult task under neoliberalism because neoliberalism has so much mastered the art of coercion and the art of manufacturing dissent and is very good at worming its way into our heads to influence our cultural choices and using those cultural choices to bolster commodification of our leisure time. You know?
Example, I had a Facebook ad pop up the other day for a Joseph Tito shirt.
Yes, yes, exactly. Oh, my God. Think about 20 years ago when a Che t-shirt was so controversial. Like, oh, God, the marketing of it was like, now we're doing Joseph Broz Tito t-shirts. This exists. It, of course it exists, because desire.
Because it's a thing.
Because it's a thing,
and
yeah.
Neoliberalism commodified it.
Yeah, exactly. And neoliberalism is intensely good at anticipating and creating desire. And that means that it's very, very difficult for us to think of our desires as something separate from neoliberalism. Disentangling that is going to be very difficult. But I think that there are some things that we should be doing. We should be fighting for more public funding for the arts, for example. You know,
we
should seek to build those spaces. We should seek to form those arts collectives. We should seek to form the band. We should sit down and read the great Marxist aesthetic criticism. We should be engaging in this now and seeking to create those spaces in whatever way we can. We should be fighting for, artists unions and musicians unions. We should be, starting more left-wing publishing ventures and things like that. There are concrete things we can do right now. The more of those we have, the more our imagination, our revolutionary imagination, is going to be prepared. And the more of a vision we're going to have hopefully, the opportunity comes to actually make it into a reality.
So you've written, quote, "Far too much of the left press is dominated by convenient answers and aesthetics as afterthought."
Mm-hmm.
What do you say about the present state of the left and its culture and its relationship to culture?
It's better than it was a couple of years ago. The current left is probably in a better position just because it has more raw materials to actually with which to maybe forge an aesthetic. We have more raw materials through which to not let it be an afterthought. But it's going to take some work to make sure that it's not an afterthought. When you are building a march, or when we are, putting together a protest, organizing, when we are doing forming an action, we necessarily have to think on the level of aesthetics. The thing that I think is unfortunate is a lot of people just think about that in terms of optics, which means like, okay, how it looks to the outside. But thinking about it just in terms of optics sells it short, because it's also about how we participate in a space. When we are putting together a demonstration or an occupation of some kind, how are we transforming the space? So we can't afford to let aesthetics be an afterthought.
Right.
We necessarily have to engage in it. It's a strategic question. Just as much as it is a question of vision, it's a tactical question too. Not just how it looks, but how are we mobilizing ourselves? How are we making ourselves more active subjects? How are we giving ourselves more agency? These are aesthetic questions once again. How are we, even if only symbolically, transforming space around us and opening up space in which people can think of a different way to use their time? A transformation of their time, as opposed to it ruling over us. What if we ruled over it? I think that we are better suited now just because we do have a left that is growing again for the first time. We have a radical left that is growing. I'm in Democratic Socialists of America. I was part of the boom that joined right after Trump got elected. And I was actually just last night at a get together with some comrades, and it comes up that, oh yeah, I'm an artist. I did some art back in the 60s, or I did, these are actually some of the older comrades that have joined. I did some art back in the 60s around like Vietnam, the liberation of Vietnam. And some other comrades in the room who've been working with them for 2 years, 2+ years, are saying, I had no idea you were an artist. And I mean,
that sounds like a mistake.
Yeah, right. But I think it's not the fault of these comrades. It's just the fact that we have just gotten to the point where we are only just starting to think about rebuilding those oppositional spaces that I spoke about earlier. Even just talking about this type of stuff, I am frequently running into people who, I'm organizing with. I do it all the time too. I'm organizing with you in this or that movement, and it'll come up. Oh yeah, I'm a poet. Oh really? Let me read some of your poetry. And it can be brilliant. It can be absolutely fucking brilliant. I think it's not just the left that thinks of aesthetic expression as an afterthought. generally, when it comes to working people, we are atomized into thinking of aesthetic expression as an afterthought. And, you know, we're taught to think no one's going to care about my poetry because I'm not a capital P poet. I'm not a good poet.
Yeah.
No one's going to care about that. And that's something we need to break with. And that's, of course, easier said than done. But I think because we actually have this, you know, the beginnings of maybe a mass socialist organization in the United States, that just simply by sheer numbers, there's at least the potential for us to be able to start to orient towards all of that better, including aesthetics, and not having that be such an afterthought.
So what would you suggest? Do you have like an essential book or two that you would like to recommend to anyone who's listening to the podcast?
So I would say that people should definitely start with Ernst Fischer's The Necessity of Art.
Okay.
Fischer was a Czech Marxist, came active. He actually broke from the Communist Party around the Prague Spring.
As one does.
Yeah, as one does, as one should. And he wrote just this excellent book on, okay, what is art anthropologically? And what does that mean for aesthetic creation and how Marxists should regard it? So Ernst Fischer, definitely. I would say people should read as much of John Berger as they can, The Ways of Seeing in particular, and also watch the documentary. It's available on YouTube, Ways of Seeing, that the BBC put together back in 1974, I want to say. I mean, you watch this and you think, God, this is how did the BBC allow something like this to go on? Because it's definitely very much pulling from, say, like Walter Benjamin. So I'd say those two books are actually a very good starting point for how to approach some of this. Yeah, so start out with that. I'd say, listen to some of the talks by China Mieville that he's done. Read some of his stuff.
Sure.
Definitely.
Read Red Wedge magazine.
Yeah, honestly, go to Red Wedge. I think that we are, hopefully, we are aiming to be an essential go-to point for...
go ahead and insert that pitch one more time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, so definitely go to redwedgemagazine.com if you want to read our online content. We also have Twitter, Red Wedge Mag, at Red Wedge Mag. We're on Facebook, of course, all of that. If you want to support us, if you want to be connected with the projects that we're doing, then definitely go to our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/redwedgemagazine, and you'll be able to find out more information about more options for subscribing, for becoming a monthly donor to Red Wedge, and being able to have access to exclusive content on there. So yeah, and you get a subscription to the journal when you subscribe also. Yeah.
Excellent. So Red Wedge is the place to go to for Marxist literary artistic criticism.
I think so. It's simultaneously something that makes me feel very proud, very humbled, and very daunted. The fact that we are the only journal in the English language that looks at all of the arts through a Marxist lens. But we definitely need as much support as we can get to help building the project, to attend conferences, to publish online and in print.
All right, folks, give Red Wedge your money. Thank you very much, Alex, for coming on the podcast. I definitely look forward to seeing what this next issue is going to contain. And I would recommend that everyone go check out Red Wedge. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I'm definitely a big fan of Regrettable Century. I think what you guys are doing is very, very essential. And I don't just say that because one of your hosts is also a co-editor at Red Wedge. We should.
Oh yeah.
We should probably make that very clear that Jason.
That's true.
He rarely introduces himself as such, and you know it's a different project, so it's not like a matter about it or anything.
This is collusion.
Yeah, this is definitely collusion. But Jason is a very. You know, we're lucky to have him on the editorial board of Red Wedge too. And so thanks very much for having me. I think it's been a really, I've been very pleased to turn up here. Opportunities are one of them or not. Every job they offer used to kick you out the door. Career opportunities are one of them or not.